Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good morning and a very warm welcome to Africa Link, live from our DW studios in Bonn, Germany. I'm Crispin Mwakideu, and these are our main stories this Tuesday, the 29th of December. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni calls on Burundi's rival factions to end the political violence in their country.
I really appeal to you, the two sides, to sit down and have a political solution so that you save our people from that suffering which they are going through now.
Nearly 5,000 Kenyans are left homeless following communal violence in the Great Rift Valley.
Our wives and children have been forced to flee from their homes due to the violence. The attackers have taken our cows. We have lost property of unknown worth.
Plus, how a young woman in South Africa is fighting for the rights of terminally ill minors. Just some of the stories we've lined up for you in this edition of Africa Link. Don't go too far.
Top story.
Deadlock in Uganda. The government of Burundi has rejected a proposal to resume talks of ending the violence on January the 6th. Members of the opposition, on the other hand, say they are hoping the talks will end with President Pierre Nkurunziza stepping down, a condition the government will likely not accept. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, who is facilitating the peace talks at his official residence in Entebbe near the capital, Kampala, Burundi government, opposition representatives, civil society groups and UN officials are participating in the talks. DW correspondent in Kampala, Alex Jita, reports.
The Burundi government is being represented in these talks by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Elainaime Nyamitwe, while the opposition's delegation is headed by Leonard Nyangoma. The process is closely monitored by the European Union, African Union, and the United Nations. However, as the two sides met with President Yoweri Museveni, these showed that they were not happy with the composition of the opposing team. Elaine Aime Nyamitwe, the Burundi Minister of Foreign Affairs, said his government was not ready to negotiate with those who attempted to overthrow President Pierre Nkurunziza.
This is a very important day because it allows Burundian citizens to talk to each other. But the authors of the coup and all those who use violent means to reach their political ends should not be legitimized through their participation in this dialogue. This is a condition which should not be ignored if we want to reach results.
Leonard Nyangoma, the chairman of the coalition of Burundi's opposition political parties and its civil society organizations that goes by the acronym CNARED, also indicated that the group he led was not happy with the coup attempt of last May. Nyangoma said his coalition wanted a number of conditions to be met by both the government of Burundi and the mediators in Uganda. The Burundi government had previously also refused to talk with CNARED, calling it a terrorist organization and blaming the coalition for mass murders. Because of the positions taken by the two parties, it is unclear whether the talks will bear positive results. President Yoweri Museveni asked everybody involved to help find a way out of the conflict.
I really appeal to you, the two sides, to sit down and have a political solution so that you save our people from that suffering which they are going through now, and also killing their opportunity, because that confusion will not allow investments to come in.
In May this year, President Pierre Nkurunziza was nearly toppled when he traveled out of the country to attend a special summit on Burundi in Tanzania. This followed Nkurunziza's announcement to run for a third term, which he went on to win. Hundreds of people have since been murdered in mass killings. The Burundi government is opposed to the deployment of an African Union peacekeeping force.
Alex Jita reporting in Kampala. And as we've just heard, the Burundi crisis was triggered by President Nkurunziza's bid for a third term, which he later won. But since then, violence has escalated and more than 200,000 have fled their homes. So what are the chances that the two sides could come to a political solution soon? My colleague Eunice Wanjiru has been finding out from Andrew Mwenda, a political commentator in Uganda.
I think that the problem of Burundi is the involvement of the international community by sponsoring international peace talks. Don't forget that Burundi had peace negotiations in Arusha, which led to the Arusha Peace Accords. And those peace accords have broken down because the belligerent parties to this conflict were not yet exhausted by war. Each side still believes it has a chance to fight.
So how much progress could be expected from this meeting, considering that Burundi government is not in agreement to the attendance of an opposition coalition, CINARED, which it has branded a terrorist organization?
I think that these talks are going to lead nowhere. First, the Burundi government is not interested in talking to the rebels. If finally they are blackmailed through international isolation and sanctions to go to Kampala for these negotiations, they will not have their heart in the negotiations because they still believe they can secure a decisive military victory. So any negotiations in Kampala will postpone but will not resolve the conflict in Burundi.
And what kind of a deal should the negotiating parties come up with to restore peace in the interim?
Well, I don't even think that peace negotiations should produce a deal. Now, of course, I understand many well-intentioned people believe that if you let this conflict continue, many innocent civilians are going to die, and that humanitarian catastrophe, we cannot afford it. But I tell these people one thing, that the international community, by sponsoring these talks, can secure short-term humanitarian objectives by reducing the killings. But it will not provide a solution that will ensure a durable and stable peace in Burundi. The only way you can achieve a permanent peace in Burundi is to have a decisive resolution of the military conflict. In the short term, there will be high humanitarian costs. Many civilians will die. A lot of property will be destroyed. But I don't see how these talks, to which neither side is committed, can produce a lasting solution. The international community and international peacekeepers cannot impose a solution on Burundi. The solution for Burundi has to come internally from the people of Burundi. You see, it is those who are most affected by this conflict who should be left to solve this conflict.
Andrew Mwenda, a political commentator in Kampala. And we apologize for the poor telephone line.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
To Kenya now, where families displaced by ethnic clashes in Olpusi Moru, Narok County, narrated the pain and anguish they had gone through in the last 4 days. The fighting has left 3 people dead and nearly 5,000 displaced. Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Joseph Nkaiseri has ordered an end to the fighting and said a police camp would be set up at the flashpoint. The clashes which pitted the Maasais and Kipsigis are a grim reminder of the 2007 and 2008 post-election violence which killed more than 1,000 people. Andrew Wasike with more on the story.
Over 250 houses have been reduced to ashes following fighting that broke out between Kenya's Maasai and Kipsigis communities who dominate Narok County in Kenya's Great Rift Valley region in the southwest of the country. The sound of crackling fire filled Olpusi Moru village in Narok County with smoke emanating from houses that had been razed by members from the two warring communities. 35-year-old John Namelok and his family were forced to spend Christmas out in the cold after the fighting erupted on December 25.
Wamama wametoroka manyumbani watoto.
Our wives and children have been forced to flee from their homes due to the violence. The attackers have taken our cows. We have lost property of unknown worth. They have even burned down our wheat farms. So this has led to a great loss for us.
The Maasai and the Kipsigis are pastoralists. They are usually armed with crude weapons to protect them from wild animals and cattle rustlers while grazing their animals. While clutching a bow and a number of arrows, Loyan Lankenua, who was part of an angry mob from the Maasai side, said that the clashes started after 2 Maasai herdsmen were killed.
They came and shot our people. One of them is called Kenyatta Ole Kuyo, the other Ole Sadera. They killed them in the dead of the night while they were asleep and stole their cows. This is why we are furious. We want the government to explain to us who killed our people and who is behind the act. We know their intention, which is to take our farms away. That is why they are killing us.
According to the regional commander, Osman Wafa, over 5,000 people were camping at Township Primary School in Narok Town after fleeing from the violence. More than 250 houses have been reduced to ashes.
We are getting a figure of about 250, yeah. But the number of people displaced seems to be very many.
No, there's a cat and mouse game going on, yeah. Fellas are, you know, attracting the attention of the officers. They will burn one place. When the officers move there, they go behind them. So we are telling them now they should plan themselves, the security officers, so they are deployed in sectors, so that at least we're able to cover every area.
None of the suspected arsonists have been arrested since the start of the conflict. Day three, and the conflict still rages on. Additional police officers have been sent to maintain peace in Olposimoru in Narok. Kenyan Interior Ministry Cabinet Secretary Joseph Nkaiseri imposed a dusk to dawn curfew in the region, but the fighting still rages on. He cautioned politicians who may have incited locals that they will be arrested if found to have fueled the violence.
Anyone found to be out during this time will be arrested, including those who have burned down schools. I'm now talking from the government point of view. If you have incited the violence by making calls and sending messages to locals, we have people from the Kenyan intelligence. We will come for you.
We'll come for you.
And that report was compiled by Andrew Wasike.
Africa on the Move.
And for Africa on the Move story, we stay in Kenya, but this time with a positive story. An organization known as the Coast Interfaith Council of Clerics has started an initiative to help reintegrate young mothers into the school system. High teenage pregnancy rate in Kenya has forced thousands of girls to abandon their education early, especially in the coastal region. According to statistics, one in five girls between 15 and 19 is either pregnant or already a mother. Yulia Milke met up with the program director and families that had benefited from the initiative and filed this report. It is now presented by Privilege Mushaniri.
When a mother heard of her pregnancy, she was devastated. She may not hear her real name. Got pregnant at the age of 16. Her son is now 1.5 years old, but Chumi is back in class to complete last year of primary school.
I was pregnant when I was still in school, and after I gave birth, I decided to go back to school and learn because life will be difficult.
The Coast Interfaith Council of Clerics helped to persuade Chumi's family to let her go back to school. During the day, Chumi's mother, Pili Ramadan, takes care of her son. The 55-year-old widow also provides for two other grandchildren. She is unemployed and feels that life has taken its toll on her.
When I learned about my daughter's pregnancy, I was so sad and bitter, and I beat her all the time. My neighbors told me that hitting someone is not the solution, and getting pregnant and still living at home is not the end of the world.
Mariam Ze, who works for the Interfaith Council, says that poverty is the main problem in the region. Young girls get lured by men offering to buy them simple items like sanitary towels. Most of the girls are between the ages of 14 and 16. They get abused and become pregnant.
The parents would ask, if she goes back to school, who will take care of the children? And we were able to talk to these parents and show sense to them that these are still children and they need to be given an opportunity.
Her best example is always that of Sylvia Juma, who got pregnant at a tender age. She, however, refused an early marriage and instead started a small tailoring shop. She took up a microcredit, which she is now able to pay back, and even employs two other young women. The Interfaith Council has projects throughout Kenya's coastal region. Apart from dealing with teenage pregnancies, it supports programs aimed at creating cohesion, peace, security, and also enhancing interfaith dialogue.
We are trying to build that social cohesion where people can coexist together peacefully despite the fact that they come from different backgrounds, different ethnic groups and different religions.
Mariam wants to make sure that young women are empowered enough to say no to the offers of men. Every week she visits different public schools to encourage the young girls to continue their education.
That report was written by Yulia Milke. Let's head to South Sudan now, where an official with rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar has denounced President Salva Kiir's decree, which created 28 new states. Ezekiel Lol Gatkuoth, a close ally of Machar, said the decree violates the spirit of the August Peace Accord. In his Christmas Eve decree, Kiir dissolved the 10 states and created 28 new ones. He also appointed 28 new governors, all of them loyal to him. James Shimanyula brings us more reaction in this report.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir's unilateral creation of 28 new states to replace the current 10 has been described by the country's rebel leader Riek Machar, as well as constitutional and legal experts, as illegal and unconstitutional. The creation of the new states was swiftly followed by the appointment of 28 governors loyal to President Kiir. Of the 28 states, Jonglei retains its state while South Sudan capital Juba becomes a new state. This is how rebel leader Riek Machar described the creation of the new states.
What he has done is creating another conflict by creating new borders, and people will resist it. They will resist it because they will say, where did you get all these borders? Cutting a chunk of land within South Sudan. He didn't support it. And now it's a tragedy. We are trying to transform the country to become a federal state.
Machar asserted that the creation of the new states violates vital parts of the peace agreement he signed with President Kiir in August this year. But South Sudan Information Minister Michael Weth Makwei maintains that the creation of the new states will not affect the power-sharing position stipulated in the peace agreement that sets the pace for the setting up of a government of national unity.
I don't see anywhere whereby the agreement has been violated. There is no provision in the agreement which ties down the hands of the president not to continue to render services and serve the interests of people. The president is acting in accordance with the provisions of the law. The president has decided to take it at this particular moment in good faith, in response to the will of the people.
Adding his voice to Information Minister Makwei's remarks, Lawrence Koribany, who represents President Kiir on constitutional issues, had this to say regarding any violation of the peace agreement.
We have not yet violated our own constitution. We made some assessments. There is absolute call for federal system.
David Deng, an independent expert on constitutional issues based in Juba, specifically reflected on the peace agreement and argued that the creation of the new states should have been approved by the country's National Assembly.
The peace agreement itself is founded on the principle of 10 states. So to change it makes a lot of people question whether or not the government is committed to a peace agreement. Any change to state boundaries or to state names requires the Council of States, which is one house of the South Sudan Parliament, and such decisions cannot be made through executive order. Such executive orders cannot be used to change state boundaries.
President Kiir's decree has automatically split central, eastern, and western Equatorial states into 8 states. Northern and western Bahar El Ghazal, Warap, and Lakes states have been divided into 10 states, while 3 states making the so-called Greater Upper Nile, Jonglei, Unity and Upper Nile, Riek Machar's political and military strongholds, have been carved into 10 new states. Alfred Lokuji, another independent expert on constitutional issues in South Sudan, expounded on what President Kiir's unilateral decision to create the new states implies.
By doing that, you clearly demonstrate that there is nothing holy anymore about governance and about the constitution. It sets back the agreement and it sets back the debate that has been going on, especially among those who believe in an orderly, politically logical and systematic way of bringing about change. Let us get this peace agreement. Let us honor it. Let us do what it takes to make it successful, to remove violence away from the lives of the people of South Sudan.
That report was compiled by James Shimanyula.
Making a difference.
And this week's Making a Difference story takes us to South Africa. Thousands of former mine workers want compensation from about 32 mining companies for the silicosis and tuberculosis they say they contracted while working in the mines. They accuse their employers of negligence and believe they are ill because of prolonged exposure to excessive levels of silica dust in the gold mines. Musician Mary Jane Matsolo has taken up the miners' cause and helped file a lawsuit against the mining industry on behalf of thousands of workers with lung diseases. Hannah Frankenfeld with a portrait of Matsolo, which has been adapted for Africa Link by Christina Kripal.
Blues musician and human rights activist Mary Jane Matsolo of the renowned Treatment Action Campaign, TAC, is once again leading a demonstration in the streets of Johannesburg calling for compensation of terminally ill miners. She played a key role in the lawsuit against the mining industry brought by 25,000 mine workers with lung diseases. For Mary Jane, protests like this one are an important part of her life, just like the Treatment Action Campaign.
We have an enormous amount of experience around social justice issues and health-related issues within South Africa.
In no time, she and her fellow activists have transformed the basement of a nearby church into an exhibition space using self-made posters and portraits of sick mine workers. It is hard work, the musician says.
I am so exhausted. It's been such a long day.
Still, Mary Jane is unrelenting in her effort to support tens of thousands of miners who fell ill working in South Africa's famous gold mines. The miners want to take on their former employers in a class action suit. But before they can do this, a court has to agree to hear the case in this format. It is now up to the High Court in Johannesburg to decide whether the class action can go ahead. This is the first tangible result of years of activism and litigation by Richard Spoor of Richard Spoor Attorneys, who took on the gold miners' case. Mary Jane Matsolo is thrilled to meet the miners' lawyer.
I'm MJ, by the way, from the Treatment Action Campaign.
Yeah, Richard Spoor, hi.
Oh, you're like my hero right now, representing these miners.
Richard Spoor represents 30,000 sick miners in this court case. He feels that civil society activists like Mary Jane perform a vital role in the miners' struggle for justice.
We need civil society to kind of stand up, mobilize them as a political force, and speak on their behalf.
These men have given their lives, literally, to the success of the economy and to the many profits that are being enjoyed by many of these mining companies. And today they're dying a slow and painful death, and it's not fair.
Mary Jane's activism, which she says she probably picked up from her father, is also rooted in the country's oppressive history.
My dad, who passed away 2 years ago, was a revolutionary songwriter, and he sang and protested against the injustices, against apartheid. And this is exactly what we are doing right here.
Be out of your mind. Why the hell you wanna come over here?
And that musical report was written by Hannah Frankenfeld.
Listen to Africa Link whenever you want. Sign up for our podcast at dw.de/Africa Link Podcast.
It's almost time to leave the studio, but before we do, here's a summary of our main stories. Burundi's government has rejected a proposal to start peace talks on January the 6th in Tanzania. Kenya's interior minister has ordered an end to communal violence, which has killed 3 and displaced 5,000. We've also been hearing about calls by South Sudan's opposition for President Salva Kiir to rescind his decree, which created 28 new states. For more news on the continent, visit our webpage dw.com/Africa. Thank you for listening. Hope you can join me same time tomorrow for a fresh look at the stories making headlines in Africa. But until then, I'm Crispin Mwakideu, wishing you an enjoyable day, and do stay safe.